guys ever talk to someone who, like, doesn't like chocolate? Yes. I have a son that doesn't like chocolate. How weird. Or someone who doesn't like ice cream, and you just kind of, do I be respectful? Do I? Okay, that's how I feel when I walk in a room anytime, because I am confident that the number one thing I want to talk about, biblical law, is not the thing that brings light to everyone else's eyes. So I love opportunities like this. I'm terrible at, like, dinner parties. I'm not kidding, it's so bad. Or anything else where it requires small talk, because I don't really know how, and I don't really care. You guys who did all the cooking tonight, that's awesome. The only part of that I could have done was I know where those chips come from. But biblical law? And I want tonight to have a directed chance to tell you, well, I'm supposed to. My assignment is to teach you how to read biblical law. Yeah, I could do that all day long, but if you don't love it the way I love it, you're not going to race home and try to figure out how to read it. So first, I want to explain to you why I love it so much. And the only way I know how to do that is to present to you my journey with biblical law. Now, first, let me back up. I'm going to get into this a little bit more later. By the way, I am a teacher, not a speaker. So if it starts to feel a little interactive and you're like, does she expect me to answer? You can go ahead and answer. And if you feel like, hey, I have a question, if it's not the place for a question, I just won't call on you. But if it is, I will. It's okay. It's a little bit more interactive. But where was I? Hold on. That's how the whole night will go. I want to walk you through my experience with biblical law. And I want to first make sure we all know what the parts of law I'm talking about are. So biblical law is usually, well, It's a misnomer, actually, but we'll get into that later. It's the part of the scriptures that are usually referred to as Torah. So most people think of Torah, and they think of the first five books of the Bible, and you think that's Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. There's lots of stories in there. Maybe this won't be so bad till 8 o'clock. But I'm going to talk about the parts that you're like, please don't. So if a man goes into battle and the Lord gives the enemies into their hands and he sees a beautiful woman and he wants her and he takes her as his wife and he brings him to her into his house and she shaves her head and pares her nails and casts off the garments of captivity and mourns for 30 days, then he can go to her and marry her. And if he gets tired of her, I forget what the word in the Hebrew is there for the text, but wants to divorce her, he can't sell her. She gets to go wherever she wishes. So the parts that are like, I mean, I'm just going to ask now. I'm supposed to ask it in two pages, but this is why I don't have notes for you all. How many of you think that that law applies today? I'm not asking a theological question. I'm asking a practical question. And how many of you feel like that law applies to your life today, like this 24-hour period, not in the present, but whatever today is, July 19th, it's my dad's birthday, July 19th, 2017. Thank you, Dr. Kutz. I taught him well. Okay, and if you think it's applicable today, would you have any clue how to go about applying it? No, okay. Good. That's the kind of feedback I want. Good. Then we all know we're on the same starting point. I will address that again later, but that's the kind of law I'm talking about. All the thou shalt not, if you have two wives and you love one and hate the other, go see a counselor. No. The biblical text says what you're supposed to do when that happens, and it just goes on and on about these things. There are some of the laws I couldn't solve for you if I had 18 hours. I still don't know yet. Why can you eat certain foods and not eat other foods? I have a hunch, but I don't really know. What about the laws that make women seem so unimportant in the ancient Near Eastern world? That's the number one question I get as a Hebrew professor at Multnomah. Number two is, how do you spell this for my tattoo? But number one is, why does God... I'm not kidding. I'm never kidding. number one is, why does God look so violent in the Old Testament? Why does he look so vicious? Why does he allow slavery? Why does he allow polygamy? Why does he treat women like this? Why is a woman after childbirth unclean for twice as long if she has a girl than if she has a boy? Why, if you think a woman has been unfaithful, can you bring her to the priest and go through this ceremony and make her drink dirt and proclaim a curse on her that her thighs will wither, which for some of us would just be awesome. But, sorry. But anyway, my daughter's in the row over there, and I'm afraid I'm going to embarrass her. But anyway, I will. Yeah, but why are you allowed to do something like that? Not just what do we do with these things, but why are they even in there? How do we not, like, some approaches are, you know, well, God is cleaning up the world, and it's better now than it was then, and that's the evidence of God in the world. That one doesn't fly for me, but I won't try to refute it. Or, and some are like, well, that, I don't know. Anyway, I won't try and go down those. I don't have enough time. But they're frustrating, and you can't just glaze over them. Because this is the God we serve, and we have to face who he is. In fact, he wants us to. He's inviting us to. So that's not like the, yay, you should understand biblical law and study it plug. That's just the where you probably are right now. Okay, that's why I'm here. Plus, I heard that last week someone said this was going to be really exciting, and I don't think anyone believed it. But, oh, just wait. Okay, so let's get to my journey. None of that was in my intro. This is why, again, I don't give handouts. All right, I'm going to walk you through my journey. First off, I love the Old Testament. I have loved the Old Testament forever. And I have a quirky personality. Like, I have to say that. After 5 minutes, we're all clear. But I have a quirky personality. And one of the pieces of my personality is if someone tells me no, it's like, find another way. So when I was little and was learning how to read, my mom and dad, I asked them, because we were learning with the Bible. I guess that's what parents do, you know, a little children's Bible. And this is apparently the good Christian thing to do with your kids. Except for children's Bibles. Ugh. But anyway, sorry. So I told my mom, I don't want to read this one. I want to read the real one. So she brings out the adult one. And I was like, no, I don't want to read that one. I want to read the first one, the real one. I have no idea why I said this. It's not a sign of intellect. It's probably just a sign of being stubborn. I have no idea. And my mom said, you can't. First off, it doesn't exist anymore. And secondly, no one can read that language. Guess what I learned how to do. So I now read and teach Hebrew. I know Greek too, but not as well. So, but I've always loved the Old Testament, partly because I love stories. Stories make sense to me. I like movies. I like novels. I am a theologian, but in my downtime, I do not read theologies. I read real books. Like stories. I love watching the plot. My kids hate watching TV with me because I always like, oh, this is where that's going. And Maya's like, we're in the intro. Hush. But I like watching how a story's going to unfold and what the author's going to do. So Old Testament with languages and history and stories. By the way, time out. When I say story, I don't mean fiction. I mean told in a narrative format. So I'm not, just in case anyone's terrified, I'm not saying I don't think this thing is historically accurate, but it's told in a way that we're supposed to figure out where the author's, what the author's main point is supposed to be. Much of it is told in story. So I love the first five books of the Bible, especially. Lots of great stories. So I'm in my PhD program, getting my PhD in Old Testament and languages and doing all this. And I'm fine with everything except for, good grief, those first five books are awfully full of this law stuff. And I'm not really that intrigued. Stories are way more fun. And I was sitting in class one day, and I was TAing. That means I was the teacher's assistant, and I, you know, so I'm not really listening because, you know, I'm the teacher's assistant. I already know everything, you know, which is pathetic, but I'm human. And as I'm reading, the professor starts reading from these chapters, Actually, I want to read these chapters afterward. What he ended up doing, he read the chapters later, what he ended up doing was reading this prayer. And it is an ancient Near Eastern text. Ancient Near East is where Israel is, and ancient is the time that they were. So this would have been from the neighboring areas around Israel. And this text, we have many, many, many copies. Whether they're exactly like this one or not, they're very similar. And some of our copies are a little bit newer, like around the Assyrian period, which is after, like, Moses' time. But they probably go way, 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 way back. And what this text reflects is the heart cry of the ancient Near Eastern people. Now, let me explain that first. When I'm talking about the heart cry, I'm talking about that one unresolved question of humanity. So for us, anyone want to take a guess what I think the unresolved question of humanity is? Not how do you read biblical law, but yeah, where are we from? What? Why are we here? What's our purpose? That's our heart cry. Would you agree? That's our cultural heart cry. Well, I always assumed that was humanity's cultural cry. I didn't recognize that that was more specific to culture and time, and that there have been other heart cries throughout creation. So if you step back in time to the ancient Near Eastern world, one of the things you need to know is that, and this will make sense to you, you guys have watched movies, read books, and gone to school, there were many, many, many gods. It doesn't matter in what paradigm or what region or what nation or who the gods were. There were many gods, and gods were responsible for everything. So if your kid got sick, it's because you ticked the god off. If your crop didn't grow well because there was a famine, then you have to appease the gods and try and get him happy with you so that he will send the rain. So this sounds like a paradigm you understand, correct? Yes? We don't need any further? Okay, good. So that's what goes on in the ancient Near Eastern world. And It never occurred to me before. Think of the ambiguity that brings. There's lots of different gods, and they're in control of everything. And by the way, these gods are kind of capricious and powerful and just not always pro-human. And so if you think about that, as I read this text, it's going to be kind of long, and halfway through it can sound a little Dr. Seuss-ish, but try to picture the ancient Near Eastern person crying out, all right? It's called the Prayer to Any God. May my Lord's heart be reconciled. May the God I do not know be reconciled. May the goddess I do not know be reconciled. May the God, whoever he is, be reconciled. May the goddess, whoever she is, be reconciled. Number one problem. God is mad, but I don't know which one. Okay? May my personal God's heart be reconciled. May my personal goddess's heart be reconciled. May my God and my goddess be reconciled with me. May the God who has turned away from me in anger be reconciled. Okay, so the God's mad at him. Something, and how does he know? Well, something bad is happening in his life. That's how he knows. May the goddess who has turned away from me in anger be reconciled. I do not know what wrong I have done. Second problem, he does not know what he's done. So he doesn't know which god is mad, and he doesn't know what he's done wrong. My God did not call my name with favor. My goddess did not call my name with favor. My God did not pronounce my name with favor. My goddess did not pronounce my name with favor. I could not eat for myself the bread I found. I could not drink for myself the water I found. Now, you guys could probably catch this even if I don't tell you this tidbit, but in the ancient Near Eastern world, futility is one of the greatest curses. So it's the idea of you never have enough. You know, you go out and you harvest all your crops, and then someone comes and steals them from you. Or you grow all your crops, and then a hailstorm wipes them out. It's you did all this work for nothing. So this is an expression of extreme angst, and a curse kind of thing is happening to him. It doesn't necessarily mean he's starving. It's just he's having a really hard time. I have perpetrated unwittingly an abomination to my God. I have unwittingly violated a taboo of my goddess. O my Lord, many are my wrongs, great are my sins. O my God, many are my wrongs, great are my sins. O my goddess, many are my wrongs, great are my sins. O God, whoever you are, many are my wrongs, great are my sins. O goddess, whoever you are, many are my wrongs, great are my sins. I do not know what wrong I have done. I do not know what sin I have committed. I do not know what abomination I have perpetrated. I do not know what taboo I have violated. A god has made me face the fury of his heart. A goddess has become enraged at me and turned me into a sick man. A god, whoever he is, has hurt me. A goddess, whoever she is, has laid misery upon me. I know, I'm only at the halfway through the first page. Over and over and over. Through that, I'm going to tell you what you're supposed to feel because you're not in my class. You don't have to get it yourselves. But the intensity of this, he is desperate to know what God he's serving and desperate to know what he's done wrong. I am miserable. I cannot see. Turn towards me, merciful God, as I implore you. I do homage to you, my goddess. I grovel before you. Problem number 3. He has no idea what to do to make it right. O God, whoever you are, turn towards me, I implore you. O goddess, whoever you are, turn towards me, I implore you. O Lord, turn towards me, I implore you. O goddess, look upon me, I implore you. O God, whoever you are, turn towards me, I implore you. O goddess, whoever you are, turn towards me, I implore you. How long, O my God, until your furious heart is calmed? How long, my goddess, until your estranged heart is reconciled? How long, O my goddess, until your estranged heart is reconciled? How long, O God, whosoever you are, until your angry heart is calmed? How long, O goddess, whosoever you are, until your estranged heart is reconciled? Men are slow-witted and know nothing. No matter how many names they go by, what do they know? They do not know at all if they're doing good or evil. O my Lord, do not cast off your servant. He's mired in a morass. Help him. Turn the sin which I perpetrated into virtue. Let the wind bear away the wrong I committed. Many are my crimes. Strip them off like a garment. O my God, though my wrongs be 7 times 7, absolve my wrongs. O my goddess, though my wrongs be 7 times 7, absolve my wrongs. O my God, whosoever you are, though my wrongs be 7 times 7, absolve my wrongs. O goddess, whosoever you are, though my wrongs be 7 times 7, absolve my wrongs. Absolve my wrongs. Let me sound your praise as if you were my real mother. Let your heart be reconciled as if you were my real mother, my real father. Let your heart be reconciled. Do you hear the, at least through the repetition, the heart cry? Which God am I serving? What did I do wrong? And what do I do to make it right? And I want to tell you that it's into that environment that God came down and gave biblical Torah. And he came down on the mountain with Moses and said, I am the Lord your God. Oh, cool. You have a name, and there's only one of you. You shall have no other gods before me. And then, hey, how many fingers do you have? I'm going to give you 10 things. You can remember this many. To do. So that you know what I expect. And by the way, if you do them wrong, I have an entire system already set up to mirror a system that's going to come later. Torah is the most beautiful demonstration of grace humanity has ever seen until the cross. It is gorgeous. So right off the bat, if you're thinking, praise God, I'm a New Testament Christian, let me tell you, you're missing the boat. I mean, yeah, sure. Does it fall in the shadow of the cross, and anything that falls in shadow doesn't look quite as good as the thing that's shading it? Of course, it's the cross, people. But it's gorgeous, okay? So once I understood where it came into culture, I was intrigued. okay, Taurus Grace, that's a new spin. I'm good with that. And then the professor started reading to me from Psalms. And he read, I'm not going to read the whole thing because it's long. I have verses marked in my text, so I'm cheating, that highlight what I want you to see. But I'm going to read from you for Psalm 119. It's the longest, of course, chapter in the book. But I'm going to read certain pieces that tell me what Old Testament authors thought about law. I would imagine that most of you have at least an idea of what you might think. See, I think you're wrong. But that New Testament authors think about law. But have you ever stopped to consider what Old Testament authors think about law? So that he starts, and it says in Psalm 119, blessed are they whose ways are blameless, who walk according to the law of the Lord. Okay, good. Yeah, that's about the guy who does it. Good for you. You're the righteous one. I'm with him. Blessed are they who keep his statutes and seek him with all their heart. They do nothing wrong. They walk in his ways. You have laid down precepts that are to be fully obeyed. Oh, that my ways were steadfast in obeying your decrees. Then I would not be put to shame when I consider all your commands. I will praise you with an upright heart as I learn your righteous laws. I will obey your decrees. Do not utterly forsake me. At this point, I'm like, yep, amen. I can say all of those things. But then he goes on, I'm not going to tell you all the verses, but verse 18, open my eyes that I may see the wonderful things in your law. Like, yeah, please. My soul is consumed with longing for your law at all times. How many of you have ever uttered that statement? Your statutes are my delight. Take away the disgrace I dread, for your laws are good. How I long for your precepts. Preserve my life in righteousness. Do not snatch the word of truth from my mouth, for I have put my hope in your laws. I lift up my hands to your commands, which I love, and I meditate on your decrees. Guys, these are the same commands that I didn't put you on the spot, but most people say, thank goodness I don't have to follow those laws. I remember your ancient laws, O Lord, and I find comfort in them. Then he turned to Psalm 19, and I won't have time to walk through the whole psalm with you because I have bigger agendas for today. But in Psalm 19, most of you probably know the psalm, I'm hoping. Maybe if you don't feel bad. It's about law, most people. Anyway. All right, it says, the heavens declare the glory of God, the skies proclaim the works of his hands. You guys heard this one? Nod with me. If you haven't, it's okay. Yeah, this is where he's going on about how amazing creation is, and it's a sign of how amazing God is. My favorite line in the first half of this, because the first half of the book is all about creation, it says, he puts a tent in the sky for the sun. I always picture like a doghouse in the backyard. So the sun is the most massive, powerful, uncontrollable, steady, consistent thing known in the ancient Near Eastern world. And God's like, oh yeah, I pitched it a tent. Look, it's my pet. I'm so big. The sun is my pet. And that's a little bit playing willy-nilly with the imagery, but that's close. It's just a gorgeous picture of the miraculous splendor of God. We live in the Pacific Northwest. How many of you have stood at the Foot or the Peak of Hood or the Coast or Mount St. Helens and just been like, wow, God is unbelievable. You can raise your hands. I want to see. Yeah, phenomenal. Well, then the author in the second half of the chapter is going to make an abrupt change. He wants to talk about the other thing in the world that expresses how amazing God is. And he's going to go a step further. The law was really good, but I'm sorry, Freudian slip. The creation was really good, but when he talks about this next thing, which is going to be Torah, law, the commandments, the do this and don't do that pieces, he adds an element in the text, and he talks about God with his personal name. This is even better than creation. Creation is majesty. Torah is personal. And he's going to say things like, the law of the Lord is perfect, reviving the soul. The statutes of the Lord are trustworthy, making wise the simple. The precepts of the Lord are right, giving joy to the heart. Joy. How many of you heard biblical law is the topic for next week. Oh, that just gives me so much joy. I know I say this a lot, but guys, I know where you're coming from. I sat there in this class listening to this. The commands of the Lord are radiant, giving light to the eyes. We tend to think of that kind of expression as like understanding, like, oh, I get it, your eyes light up. But in reality, in Hebrew, this is the expression that's used, for example, when Jonathan, the son of Saul, hasn't heard the command that they're not supposed to eat, and their men are starving, and he dips his staff in some honey, and he tastes it, and his eyes are lightened. Why? Because he's revived, he's refreshed. This is what law does to you. So basically, on any given day, if you need some extra kick, you can either go get a coffee or read some law, or go get a massage or read some law. So this is kind of the attitude that the Old Testament uses to talk about the law. Let me give you one more. I know, don't worry, you're not supposed to have your heart switched yet. I just want you to see that people you really, really, really trust, like these guys, not just me, these guys, love biblical law, all right? When Moses writes about it, before he even gets started into all of the Ten Commandments and the laws and the things like that, he's about to go there. In chapter 5, he's going to jump into this, but in chapter 4, he gives an entire chapter's worth of introduction, kind of like I'm doing. And he says, "Hear now, O Israel, the decrees and the laws I'm about to teach you." I'm going to skip down to verse 5. "See, I have taught you decrees and laws as the Lord my God commanded me, so that you may follow them in the land you are entering to take possession of it. Observe them carefully, for this will show your wisdom and understanding to the nations." So following the law is evangelistic. The law is Israel's first missionary tool. Okay, we look at law like, oh, this might get in the way of me telling people about God. If they see how I have to live, they aren't going to want any part of this. "They will hear about these decrees and say, 'Surely this great nation is wise and understanding. What other nation is so great as to have their gods near them, the way the Lord our God is near us whenever we pray to him?'" They saw these laws as relational. We tend to teach them as the Old Testament's not very relational. It's all rigid and there's this heavy yoke on you, which, by the way, the Deuteronomy tells you it's not heavy, but that's okay. That's how we perceive it. Sorry, can you tell I have a pet peeve? Anyway, where was I going? Oh, and yet they're saying this is the relational part. It's not, the cross is relational, the law is at a distance. I had one student once, I was teaching in a class, and when I'm teaching, I really want to know where the students are coming from first, and I was pushing them and pushing them, pushing them, because they're all telling me how much they love Torah. And I'm like, no, you don't. Yes, I do. I love the Old Testament. And finally, big burly student. His name is CJ Young. He teaches up in Seattle in a church. Beard to hear, 4 times my size. Anyway, he pounds his fist on the table and he said, "Fine, I'll be straight with you. This is how I really feel. I know scripture tells us that God is the same yesterday, today, and forever. But I want the God of the New Testament where the veil has been ripped." Do you understand the allusion? Yep. "So that they can, that the Gentiles can walk in the temple courts. I don't want the God of the Old Testament that just kind of keeps me pushed back." That's not at all what Moses is talking about with his law. He's like, this is so the nations, the Gentiles, will see, and they're going to see it as personal. Wait, your God answers you? Your God's with you? Okay, I just looked at the clock, and we have so much more to talk about. Scripture loves law. Law is grace. That should have been enough. I was kind of on fire. But then I started working with the laws. Like, if a man has 2 wives and he loves one and he hates the other, they aren't even good settings. They're like soap operas. They're really tough to deal with. For my dissertation, I handled just 7 of them in the text of Deuteronomy that dealt anything that had a father in it. I was doing my dissertation on the role of the father in ancient Israel. And all but one of the settings were just ugly. Like, you could write, you know, a TV series on domestic violence and dispute, and, you know, if your son is rebellious, if you go to war and God gives the enemy into your hand, I said that one earlier. If you marry a woman and you find something indecent about her, if you marry someone and find out she wasn't a virgin, then you can, like, publicly shame her, or, you know, there's this, it's just, I mean, this is the scriptures I'm looking in here to find out how to look more like God, and it's got all these settings that look, well, that's not how we're supposed to look in the church, right? Yes, no, anyone awake still? And it was bothersome to me, so I'm wrestling through these laws and trying to understand them, and I've got the heart passion. I've got Psalm 19 and Psalm 119 and Deuteronomy 4 and the mindset of grace. But here was the fundamental difference, or the difference, the step I had not yet taken. I didn't understand what law was. To me, and if I voice this and it sounds like heresy, it is. But I didn't know it until I spoke it out loud. It made perfect sense to me. To me, law was the bridge before the cross. You know that picture? I don't know if you guys have all seen it. You've got us on one side and God on the other, and then the cross neatly fits in the middle, and you can now get across. To me, law was that, because I was broken and unclean, and law would somehow clean me up. Because I had this concept that God's holy and I'm not. And so if I live a certain way, namely if I could figure out these laws, or thank goodness I don't have to because I'm a Christian and Jesus did it, I can push those all aside. But now I'm finding out that maybe I'm misunderstanding the laws. But if I could live just good enough, maybe I could, I don't know, this is where the heresy part comes in. Earn God's favor, be good enough, be, I can even put it on God, be made holy enough. And I, you know, as soon, I hope you can catch it, as soon as you speak it out loud, it doesn't work with our theology. And so then I'm like, well, great, what is law for then? Why is he giving it? And there's this one passage, there's a bunch of passages, a ton of these, but I'm going to read one. Well, there's another one I'm thinking of now, too. Exodus 9, he talks about Israel, and he says, I'm doing this so that you may know, so that Israel may know, so that the world will know that I am God. And I'm like, okay, then we'll all see him. But I came to understand he was giving law so that we would have a picture of what he looks like. So follow me with this logic if you can. God is perfect, yes or no? Okay, so his character is perfect. If he gives laws, can he give laws that are somehow inherently immoral, sinful, messed up? He's requiring things of us. The question I just asked is the wrong question to ask, but it's helpful to ask. It's the wrong question because it leads us down the wrong road. The right question is, well then, if he's giving us laws, they will be, or will they or will they not be, I made it into a question, according to his character. Yes. So laws are a picture of the character of God, right? Yeah, theologically you're saying, yeah, half of you are still going, there's stoning in there. And I really like shrimp. I really like shrimp. But they are a picture of the character of God. And what I came to understand is that Israel, I always thought laws were too hard for me to understand. They're too big, they're too vast, kind of like Paul's writings. I didn't really say that. They're just too theological. And I realized, no, they're not. They're in a story culture. They're actually Torah. The word Torah means instruction. They are teaching. Some of the best and most effective teaching methods I have ever seen that say, here's what I'm like. Now, there are places where he comes right out and says, here's what I'm like. I am patient, long-suffering. That's the same as patient, but I can't think of the verse right now. So full of loving kindness. And he tells us all those things, right? Gracious. Slow to anger. Can you tell me I'm having trouble with the patience one this week? He tells us he's all those things. So he does come right out and say who he is. You don't have to raise your hands for this one. It might reveal a lot about your stage of Christian maturity. How many of you think that in your own walk with the Lord, predestination or eschatology is more difficult to understand than love? God's love. Forgiveness. See, when I was in grad school, I thought if I could just figure out predestination or eschatology, which, by the way, I really don't care about at all, so never ask me to come speak on that topic, then I would, like, oh, be there like God. And then after years of being a Christian, it was like, no, you know what, Lord, I'm really struggling with the simple things like forgiveness and how do I deal well with my family? I'm in charge of them. But why can't I just scream a little more so they'll do it faster? You know, we know it's bad, but why is it really that bad? Or love. I mean, I can get that God loves me. But do you guys really understand how much he genuinely likes you? I didn't. I still don't. I can preach a whopping. Actually, I can't preach anything. I can only brag about it when no one knows that I don't preach. I can teach a whopping class on how much God likes us based on the text of Exodus. Whoa. But then I leave, and I feel like I've already ticked him off. It's the simple pieces of God that are hardest for us to get. So he says, I'll give you practice. I'm going to let you go do these things so that you can understand what they are. And one of these days, when you're taking care of the widows and the orphans and the homeless, how many of you in this church hear that that's not only one of our responsibilities, but you're encouraged to go out and do those things because it's all over the Old Testament? Yes? No? Yeah, this is an awesome church for that. I love this church. I am so proud of this church. This church gives me hope. Do you know why you go do those things? Because one of these days, while you're doing this, you're going to realize, I have something, they have nothing, and it gives me so much joy to give to them. Hold on. There's a paradigm there. God has everything. I have nothing. Oh! That's the point of law. The point of law is to know who God is better, not to clean you up so that he can, like, risk his holiness to be near you. No, it's so that you know who he is. It's very much like teaching young children. When I'm teaching my kids a concept, I use this, I need a new example, but you haven't heard it before, so I'm safe. Last summer we went camping and we're teaching my son to whittle on a stick with a knife. He got a new knife. He's so proud. He was 8 at the time. And I didn't just say, okay, I'm going to give you a knife and a stick, and you want to hold the knife by the handle, and you want to put the stick in one hand and the knife in another, and you want to brush the knife against the stick, but it should go away from you. No! Nor did I just hand him and say, don't cut yourself. No, what did I do? I put the stick in his hand and the knife in his hand, and then I took another stick and another knife, and I said, watch this. I don't want to do this. I don't want to pull it this way, babe. Where would the knife go? Right, yeah. I want to push it that way. And then I let him practice, and it's a pretty dull knife. It's his first one. So we're kind of safe, and there's margin for error. And we can use that kind of principle with moral things. We can use that kind of principle with anything. But that's how we teach our children. Guess what, guys? We're kind of dim-witted, and God made us so he knows. he didn't write some theology so you could sit down and figure out who he was because you're smart enough to do that. No, he's like, guys, I love you and am gracious toward you. Want to know what that looks like? Go take care of the homeless. You'll see. Or, you know, you ask all the time, am I a mean and vicious God? That's a question I told you, number one question I get. Deuteronomy is packed with laws on how you're to exercise your authority. And not only does it tell you how to exercise your authority, it tells you most of the time you might have authority in the eyes of society, but you're not to use it in that setting because it would be overstepping and it wouldn't take care of the other person. Because that's how God exercises his authority. So do I have all the ancient Near Eastern war scenarios and slavery and, you know, stop at 40 lashes? Oh, great. How merciful. Do I have all those texts figured out? No. But do I understand how God uses authority and that he is trustworthy? Yes. How do I know? Because in Deuteronomy 25, he told me, if someone owes you something and it's in their house and you go to get it, it's rightfully yours. It belongs to you. And it's in his house. Should I be able to go get it? Yeah, right? Yes, please tell me we're not so liberal. Yes, okay, I should be able to go get it. It's mine, and he owes it to me. And the text says, stop at the threshold. Don't go inside. Why? Because you have too much power in that setting. The only place that the person who owes you something has as his dominion is in his home. Outside of his home, he owes you something. He's indebted to you. In his home, he's in his space. Stop at the threshold. Do you have a right to go in? Sure, he owes you something. Do you exercise that right? No, that's not what healthy authority looks like. I love that law. Usually I don't have that much to lend to people, so I don't ever have to apply that law in its specific sense. But can I use that law all the time when I have authority? Yeah. I have authority over my kids. Diminishing authority as they get older. But a lot of it, I could do a lot of damage with the authority I have. And it'd be called parenting. And yet I don't want to. Students, I have to address a moral issue with a student. How do I go about doing that? I have a lot of authority. What if I don't want to address a moral issue? I just have a gentle concern. I'm not even sure if I'm right. Do I call him into my office and carefully, if at all, because I've got a name plaque on my door and they look at me more highly than I deserve because of the position I'm in, and I could render some trauma if I'm not careful. So does the law apply to me when it comes to the threshold? Just stop there? Yeah. Furthermore, can I trust a God who teaches me how to use authority that way? Even if I don't understand all the pieces about warfare and stoning and, well, I think so. Because that's who he says he is. He drew a picture for me. A picture that's imperfect only in that it's lived out in human flesh. So when I act out on law, it's still just me that's doing it. And this is where Christ gets so exciting. Because guess what? Perfect law meets perfect man. Yeah, it's gorgeous. It's like, I don't know, the fulfillment of the law or something. Thank you. How easy is this? Guys, this isn't rocket science. It's just scripture. But it is beautiful, beautiful. So here's my question. Usually at the beginning of class, when I'm teaching, I ask students, you know, what's your number one question for me if I tell you the topic is biblical law? And they all ask, do we have to follow biblical law, right? Maya said last week that someone came up to her and was like, what's it like living as the daughter of someone who loves biblical law? And then who knows what was in that person's mind, but Maya and I picture like, you know, are you allowed to breathe on the Sabbath? Can you wear mixed fibers in your clothing? It doesn't probably look that, except for she has way more lectures at home on biblical law. She'll say something and she'll be like, I don't think this person handled it right. And I'm like, that reminds me of Deuteronomy 23. And she's like, I'm out of here. So in that sense, poor kid. But hold on, I was going somewhere with this. I hate when I get on a rabbit trail. Oh, thank you. You guys are awesome. I think this is falling out. Yeah, hold on. So, hold on. I don't want to scream in your ears. Better? Okay. So the number one question is, do we have to? Now, let me summarize what I have tried to present to you. Biblical law is an invitation to a relationship with God, where you're allowed, slash allowed, I say allowed because I got Sabbath in the back of my mind. Do you know how many people fight over Sabbath? Should we do it? Do we have to? You get a whole day a week off, people. Biblical law is an invitation to relationship with God whereby you can know him better. And I promise, as you get to know him better, you'll like him even more. And the way you learn to know who he is better is by practicing all of these real life illustrations and figuring out that that peace that he's going for here is a peace that reflects his character. And so a word like gracious gets skin and bones. And it's not just this concept like gracious. Now the question isn't do we have to, it's how? Help me understand this stuff. I want to know. I've got to tell you, I probably shouldn't say this. I'm me. Whoa, and there's a step there. Maybe you'll remember that instead of what I'm about to say. Sorry, hold on. God giving me time to decide not to say it. I'm going to say it anyway. There is nothing cooler, better, more phenomenal, shocking, amazing, inviting, gracious, loving, kind, blah, 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 in scriptures than Christ. Christ is perfect. And that gets kind of intimidating for me. So I read all the stories and I'm like, yeah, this is who I want to be like. I can't make this bread stuff happen out of two loaves. Five loaves? Five loaves. It's New Testament. Five loaves. How do I emulate this? You know, I can read the Sermon on the Mount. If I follow this stuff right, I'm going to have no hands. But the Old Testament law that's kind of dumbed down for me, I can see, it's not that I can get it done and do it all the time, but I can see a picture of the character of God that invites me in, other than the New Testament with Jesus, because he is God. There is nothing in Scripture that tells us more about the character of God than biblical Torah. And our churches are putting it on a shelf at best and degrading it, sometimes from the pulpit, at worst. It's like we have this self-portrait of God and we're not looking at it. That hurts my heart. I want to understand more of this stuff. All right, I have 5 minutes till I'm supposed to give you time to answer or to ask questions. And I didn't get into any of the overarching principles of how to look at biblical law. Here are your options. You're going to vote. And then I'm going to pick which one I really want to do if the hands aren't clear. I can give you an example of a biblical law. I'll probably go back to that first one about the captive woman and show you how it's applicable. I can give you real quick a snapshot of what are the main principles that we look for, or I can go to questions earlier. So you're going to raise your hand when you want the first, when you want the thing I'm saying. How many of you would like a snapshot in 5 minutes of the main principles we need to use to look at? Okay. How many of you want to see, like, an illustration with the captive woman? Oh, you guys are no help. All right. All right. Do them both. All right. All right. I'm going to give you the principles in a brief version, and I'm going to keep looking at the clock, and then I'm going to work it out for you. Okay, so some of the principles that, and they have labels because I've given them labels, but I change the labels every time I teach them because unfortunately there isn't a lot of help on this. And the reason there's not a lot of help on this in the churches or in scholarly world is because not a lot of people understand what biblical law is. So do we have any lawyers in here? Okay, cool. Yeah, so much smarter than I am. That is awesome. Yeah, uh-huh, sure. Okay, that was so gracious. Law in the United States, about how many books would it take to fill, to write down all the biblical laws? United States laws. Thousands. Libraries full. People are trained just to read through the books and find the law that's applicable and the way it was applied to see if it was right. And the number one thing about laws, I mean, I know this because I watch crime TV. It's the only way I know it. But there's always a loophole because if it's not written, you can get around it. Right? Yes? Okay. Pretty sophomoric view of law, I understand. But it's what we think of when we think of law. Biblical law, in fact, ancient Near Eastern law, there's tons of law from the ancient Near Eastern world. And I love to read them. I'm not sure why, but I love to read them. And there are some differences with than the stuff you see here, but most of the differences have to do with the concept of righteousness and the reasons God tells you to do these laws. Those are written into our texts. They aren't written into ancient Near Eastern laws. The only reasons that I can find in the ancient Near Eastern laws are either like equity, so it's equal or fair, or the king will sometimes say, I'm making these laws as a sign that I am just. I run a just, you can trust me because of these laws. And that's the same principle that the biblical laws are giving. When you read through, anyone ever like sat down and read Deuteronomy 12 to 24? Very good. Someone assigned it, didn't they, Andrew? Yeah. You read it and you're like, what in the world? Okay, I can't eat pig, and I need to build a fence around my roof, and I should stop at the threshold, and if I marry two women, like all interspersed in the same section, and it just seems totally sporadic and antiquated, and, I mean, if you were looking for a loophole, you can find one on just about anything. It's because biblical law isn't written to, oh, that's bad. I was going to say it isn't written to be exhaustive, but I'll tell you, biblical law is exhaustive because, I'm going to make sure I get the right words here, instead of being sporadic, it's highly comprehensive in biblical law because the biblical laws are representative. Now, how do I merge those all into one principle for you? Biblical laws are in a story culture and they represent broader settings. We know this is true. We know for two reasons. One, because Paul does that with law. When he takes a law from the Old Testament, the one about is it an ox or a donkey? Ox, thank you. Somehow I picture it in my head as a donkey, but I know it's an ox. When the ox is treading the grain, and Paul take, we would look at that and go, oh, this is a law about animals, right? It's an ox treading grain. Well, Paul says, takes it and applies it to pastors. Gee, thanks. He's doing that because the law is about how do you exercise your authority fairly for the well-being of others. If someone's working for you, they should reap not just their salary, but the benefits of what you're doing. Like a pastor, if he's working for you, pay him. And so there's a principle. Now, why did they pick an ox? So first principle, it's representative. It can shift application, which makes us really uncomfortable because, wow, how do we know then the limits on our application? Well, it's about relationships, and relationships are messy. I can't give you rules to make it less messy, but I can tell you if you don't allow it to be what it is, it's not going to be very functional. So allow it to be messy. Why did they pick an ox? Well, let me ask you this. In a culture that has men that may be a little bit higher in status than women, women may be a little bit higher in status than servants, children fit in there somewhere, but they probably don't have the same authority as adults, and I don't know what other, they have concubines, they have, so you've got social structures. Let me ask you this. If an ox can eat the food while it's working, can a servant? Well, duh, yeah. Ox is an animal. If an ox can a woman? Yeah. If an ox can a child? Yes. So Deuteronomy is, or these laws are picking the extreme so that you know how to apply them in another setting. The one about the captive woman that I alluded to earlier. I'm not done the principles yet, but I'm jumping to the captive woman one. In the captive woman passage, it's actually, I'm not saying it doesn't apply in that setting exactly the way it was said. If you go into battle and the Lord gives him the enemy into your hand and you see a beautiful woman and you take her and you bring her to your home and she shaves her head and pares her nails and casts off the garments of her captivity and mourns her father and mother for 30 days, then you can marry her. And if, I don't remember what happens, he doesn't like her anymore, you cannot sell her, or she gets to go free. You cannot sell her or benefit from her in any way. That applies in its normal context, which fortunately for us isn't really, we're like post-Geneva Convention, that just sounds like the most horrible thing in the world. That poor woman, and there's no way I find anything beautiful in that passage as a practice, but what the passage represents is incredibly beautiful. They take the highest person in society, the only person higher than the victorious male warrior, right after victory, is a king. There's nothing more powerful right at that point. When it comes into relationship, and I'm not talking about strength power, I'm talking societal power, the rights he's been given. I might rock some boats here, but not by God, by society. This is the way it is in their world. And you contrast that, not just contrast, but you're bringing into relationship with the lowest in society. She's a woman, which really wasn't that bad a thing in the ancient Near Eastern world. But she's a woman. She's a foreign woman. She's a heathen foreign woman. And she's now a defeated foreign heathen woman. The chapter before tells us in chapter 20, you sell those. Those are the people you can round up and sell as slaves. There's nobody lower on the food chain. And yet there's going to be interaction because the guy wants to marry her. So there's going to be interaction. What is that interaction supposed to look like? This is a picture of the highest in authority interacting with the lowest in authority. What is it supposed to look like? And from the most we can tell, those actions in the middle that she's to do are, she casts off the garments of her captivity for one thing. This is the only one that's really clear. It means she's not a captive anymore. She's Israelite. Well, not her heart. Her heart isn't skipping and happy, but her status goes up. She's allowed to mourn. Not very long, considering all she's been through. I wouldn't mind if God rewrote this one a little bit. But he's not to touch her after that, the text says. It literally says he can go into her. So he can go marry her after that. He has to bring her into his home before then to provide for her, take care of her. But don't touch her for 30 days. She has to mourn. She's got to adjust. The shaving and the nails, those are a little bit more difficult to figure out because there's so many things they could stand for. But usually it's the shedding of one culture and the putting on of another culture. And so everything in there shows that she's no longer to be treated like a captive. She's to be treated like an Israelite. So what does that tell us about, one, authority? Oh, wait, there's another piece of evidence there, by the way. When he divorces her, he can't sell her. Well, really? Did they just go around selling all their divorced spouses in the Old Testament? Like, oh, everyone else can. Why do they say he can't sell her? Because chapter 20 says that you can sell captives, captive women. In chapter 20, in this place, in chapter 21, it says, nope, you can't sell her. He would assume he might have that right. But the text says no, because you caused her to be humiliated, a reference to her, his divorcing her. You used your authority once already to say she wasn't good enough. You don't get to use it again. She's an Israelite woman now. So this whole passage is about authority, and it highlights the value of marriage. Now, how many of you think that a passage on authority that highlights the value of marriage is applicable to you July 19th, 2017. It paints a beautiful picture of what could be, has all the makings of a really ugly relationship. And scripture, I wish, who doesn't, that it just went in and said, nope, don't touch her. But this is the other beautiful principle I want to show you. So the first one was that it's comprehensive and it's representative. The other one is that it is not representing the idyllic. See, when I went to the Old Testament to do my dissertation, I was expecting to find, like, this is what I'm supposed to look like. And then I go back and I read all these disgusting settings. I don't know how to explain to you. I just have to hope that you understand the same thing. I don't know what to do when I find all this brokenness. Because I assumed that if God set a law and it reflected his character, it therefore looked pretty. Right? Well, praise God it doesn't. Because if it looked pretty, where would that leave us? When we're addicts, when we have gone through a divorce, when we have sinned, when we have not exercised our authority well, when we have, you name it. It is not idyllic. It instead tells you how you walk out righteousness in a broken world. I'm a goody two-shoes, so it's not my direct experience because I'm such a goody two-shoes. You can tell when I start bragging about, like, really big things I've done. Like, I smoked a cigar once, one time. And my daughters are like, oh, brother, I was there. You barely put it in your mouth. But go, Mom, you rebel. But when I talk to my friends, when I talk to my students, the common experience I hear is that church is not the safest place. You know, I'm walking through this right now, grief. Or I just went through a divorce. Or I struggle with this. Or I'm not who they think I am. And what would the church look like if we understood the concept that God, from the very beginning when he introduces himself, steps into a broken culture and says, there's hope. You can walk righteously. When there's no clear right or wrong, There's no, I get to do this over and make it perfect from the beginning. It's just life and it's gross. There's a way to reflect God in it. And he doesn't say, you can never do this in this situation, because the situations are all different. Instead, he gives you pictures. Use your authority for the benefit of someone else. Hold your authority back if it's going to hurt someone else. Take care of those who have less. Give to those. Don't, little things, don't withhold someone's wages. Like, if they're working for you, pay them every day. Well, in our culture, we'd switch that a little bit, but pay them every week. Don't make them ask you for money. It's horrible. They're working for you. Make sure they're okay. Check in. Hey, I just hired you, my TAs. Do you need an advance on your work for me? I know your situation isn't great. In fact, you were living in your car a few months ago, and you've been staying in my house now. Do you need an advance? Ask them. Protect them. Use your authority to their benefit. Don't get walked on, taken advantage of, but use your authority. That's biblical law. And then that leads me to the final principle I'm going to state, and I've already given you the example. Our laws are written by authority, right? Biblical laws are written for those in authority. They're written to the powerful people, the ones who get to make the decisions. Because the biblical laws, and well, let me back up. In American culture, we have rights. Heck, we have a Bill of Rights. My mentor calls the Ten Commandments the Bill of Other People's Rights. Biblical law is written for those in authority and tells them how to exercise it. And I've said this a million times, pull it back. But it's not written to promote them. It's written for them to promote everyone else. It's the only way you can follow it. So those are the prime, I'm trying to see, do I have other primary principles? Can I just throw this one in? It's not even a principle. You know how we get so frustrated about God in the Old Testament? Is he bad or is he good? And why didn't he just say you can't marry captive women? And why does he let slavery go on? And la, 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 la. That slavery law? Laws are in context. They're teaching something. So the one about slaves that everybody gets so upset about, and I understand, I don't think we should have slaves either. Ta-da, I said it. Yeah. It's a no-brainer. But the law in the scriptures doesn't bother me because it's written to a society that already has slaves, and what the law says is you guys get to take a break. We're going to call it a Sabbath. And it's one of the coolest breaks you could ever imagine, but I'm not going to go into it today. It's awesome. But when you take it, your slaves get one too. In fact, they don't just get one once a year, but every 7 years, they get to go free. Done. And we're like, why did God allow slavery? What could he do? I mean, what's he going to do? Go in and say, no slaves. And Israel's going to go, okay, whatever. He said a lot of things, no, and they did it anyway. Right? But that law isn't about slaves. It's for slaves. They get Sabbath. The law is about the weaker. All right, there's one more principle I'm thinking of, but I'm going to let it go. Questions? Can you tell I love this stuff? What's the other principle? It's related to that one. It's culturally based. This one makes people uncomfortable, so you can, do you have anything you can throw at me? I want to ask that before. Not idyllic. It's not idyllic. It's on my list as number four. It's not idyllic, but it's how do you respond righteously in a broken situation? The other one is, because it's culturally based, we look on the surface of laws. I don't even know how to say this one yet, but it's culturally targeted, not, and I'm going to use a hot button just as an example, not gender targeted. You know, well, why were men allowed to do this and women aren't? And why does it say men this and it's always the women? It's talking to the person who's in authority and who probably had more authority. What was going to come up more? A man abusing his authority or a woman abusing her authority? The guy. So he's going to talk to him and tell him, this is what you do, this is what you don't do. There are times that you will have a law, the divorce law, for example. The divorce law does not mean what we think it means. If a man and a woman are married and he finds something indecent, he uncovers the nakedness of a thing about her, and he writes her a bill of divorce, and he sends her on his way, and she goes and marries another, and the other either dies or leaves her, the first guy can't marry her again, that one. And I'm sorry, guys, I'm going to do the woman thing for a minute. Only white evangelical males could look at that passage and say, oh, look, the woman's dirty. That's what they all do to it. Oh, now she's an adulteress. So remarriage is akin to adultery, and I'm not talking about what the New Testament says. I'm talking about from this passage. Everyone looks at it and finds something wrong with the woman. Well, and then they make it about all kinds of crazy things you would not believe. They make it about incest. Once they've already been married, they're like family, so you can't go back together because that would be incest. Okay, I mean, scholarship, if you ever just need to sit back and just laugh, read some things we who think we're really smart have written. Scary. Anyway, it's really related to that last law I talked about where you have to curb your authority. So if you have married and then there's nothing wrong with her, she goes and marries again. The guy could just love her till the day he dies or divorce her, but something has to happen to make her eligible again. And the intervening marriage probably just means it wasn't that big a deal. He could have stayed married to her. It wasn't like she had had an affair and deserved to be stoned, or she's marryable. The second guy can't marry her again because he has caused her to declare herself unclean. He publicly humiliated her and divorced her. We call it the divorce passage, but it's pointing to the wrong that was done in the first marriage and saying abuse is just bad. Now, I don't know all the applications. That's why I love being a scholar and not at the front. But the text is against the abuse that the divorce represents. Someone who hurts you doesn't get to hurt you again. And who's supposed to step in and make sure that doesn't happen? The community. Now, I don't know what that looks like. Oh my gosh. I'm walking on really thin ice here because there are so many different scenarios, and I'm talking from my little cloud in the academic sky that can just say things. But we're not understanding the text right, and here was what links me to the principle. How do I know this for sure? Like, how can I verify this? Well, this same passage is used by God in Isaiah. He references this passage. He just points right back to him. And in that case, Israel, the female, is the offender. And he, God, is the one who has been offended. Should he ever go back to her? No. So the genders are reversed. The text is not about the genders. Everyone always wants me to come in and talk about women things. The text isn't talking about those things. It's talking about authority. In different cultures, a lot different authority in different ways. And in the Old Testament world, I can tell you with absolute confidence, although you can read all kinds of different things, in the Israelite culture, in the family sphere, male and female had equal authority. I'm not talking egalitarian, complementary. I'm just saying when it comes to like raising the kids and making decisions about them and all that kind of stuff, biblical text is, the examples are really clear, equal authority. And in social spheres, which often overlap, I mean, what's divorce? Social, family, they overlap, so they're not two clean circles. But in social spheres, the male sometimes had a higher level of authority. He had a higher voice in society. So it's talking about social structures and authority and not those superficial things we see on the text. Okay, I don't even know if we have time for more questions. Some of you have to go to bed and go to work in the morning. Thank you, guys. I love this stuff so much. Can I just sit down?